My name is Lou Lasher, and I'm going to be talking about audio description from the perspective of an amateur describer. That would be me. As an amateur describer, in the past year I've described 10 movies and 20 episodes of the TV show The Twilight Zone. Where I first got involved in audio description was a couple years ago. I was at a ski trip from Ski for Life, which some of you may know is a group for visually impaired cross-country skiers. And at the event, they gave out free copies of a documentary movie on a DVD. So when I got home, I watched the DVD. And I'd already listened to audio description before this. You know, whenever I get a DVD, I always check to see whether it has audio description. And unsurprisingly, this did not. It was, you know, a low-budget documentary. They gave out this movie, which was of interest to visually impaired people, and, you know, half the people on the trip were visually impaired. So I considered it significant that it didn't have audio description, so I just decided to do it, despite my lack of any other experience or training for doing this. And since then, I've managed to find other movies that are not described. And I've just done those. In addition to learning about audio description by listening to other people's descriptions and by doing my own, I discovered last year that the ACB has seminars that teach audio description. I didn't actually take any seminars, mind you, but I decided instead of the $500 seminar, I would get the $10 Kindle book. It's actually pretty good. The title of the book is The Visual Made Verbal, and it's either the best or only book on the subject of audio description. Author is Joel Snyder, who some of you may know from the ACB. He has for a long time been a pioneer and an advocate and also a teacher of audio description. So a lot of what I'm saying is stuff that I agree with him from this book. As an amateur, I'm not affiliated with any production company, so I do the whole production process myself. I write a script for the audio description. That's mostly what I'm going to be talking about in this talk. And then I make a recording of me reading the script, and then I do lots of audio editing. That's probably the largest percentage of my time. There's all sorts of stuff with mixing the audio description with the original soundtrack, and synchronizing it properly, and sound balancing, and fixing my many mistakes. And then I do quality checks, which is a fancy way of saying I listen to it a lot, and or watch the movie. But you can find different problems from listening while also watching it visually, and sometimes just by listening to it on its own, find different problems. And then, when I'm satisfied, I publish the resulting audio product in what I call the audio description gray market, which is what I call the movie vault, where it is available for free download. So, getting back to writing the script, the actual work amounts to sitting at a computer, watching a DVD very slowly and carefully, doing a lot of pausing and rewinding. I haven't measured this, but I think I work in units of about 5 to 10 seconds. So it's a very slow way to process a movie, and just writing down a lot of notes. The conceptual steps, and Joel Snyder, we have different words for it, I call it perception, prioritization, and putting into words. He doesn't use alliteration with his. Perception is basically just paying very close attention, much more than I would normally pay when watching a movie, to what is going on visually in the movie, and also trying to understand why. Because often, especially in a well-made movie, things are put into the movie for a reason. It can be to advance the plot, or to develop character, or just provide background. The more I understand the reasons why something's going on, the better equipped I am to prioritize which things are more important to describe. Also, in these 5 to 10 second intervals, the part about putting into words starts right away. Some movies are more straightforward than others, and you can actually write stuff that makes sense on the first pass. Even if, you know, sometimes I may not know what's going on, I don't know who the characters are, sometimes I can't even figure out what's happening, I always write down something, because at least that way I've retained my first impressions. And also, if I'm not sure, it's like, what just happened? I think it's, I'll write down the guess, and I'll write down my questions. So I'm really taking a lot of notes. And then usually it only takes a second pass through the movie, because by the time I've gotten through the first time, I know what's going on, and probably at least know who the characters are. So the second pass, watching through the DVD, pretty much have a complete script. When I say complete, that's not the same as final, because throughout the process, I'm open to changing things, which means like while I'm reading the script, sometimes I'll just blurt out something that turns out to be better than what I wrote. And then there's the quality review process. The writing process just keeps going on. Here's a good time to now talk about what audio description is and what it is not. Here's my definition. Audio description is description, in words, visual content. The goal of audio description is to provide to the listener, as best as possible, the same level of information that the visual viewer gets, but no more than that. The general rule is to describe, but not interpret, or explain, or comment. Audio description is not the same as narration, although they are similar, because narration can also give you additional explanations and background information beyond what's in the visual content. And audio description is very different from an audio book, because a book can have omniscient narration or even first-person narration that can be telling you what's going on inside the mind of characters. And that's well beyond the visual content. Same level of information as the visual, but no more. Very basic example of this, how to refer to characters. The general rule is not to use the character's name until someone else in the movie has done so. It seems a little picky, but that is the general rule. Sometimes you end up with these sort of provisional descriptions, just like the chubby old man, or there's one in Sharknado, the main character, before they said what his name was, I just called him Surfer Dude. Yeah, and then once someone else in the movie has said the name, then you just use the name. There are exceptions to this rule. I just finished early this morning doing a Superman movie, a Superman 3, and there are characters that need no introduction. Superman, Clark Kent, Lois Lane, or Jimmy Olsen. So I didn't wait until someone said, hey, Superman. It's like, obviously, that's Superman, that's Clark Kent. If you ever watch the TV show Modern Family, they have, I think they're up to now 12 main characters that they don't have to introduce each episode. More interesting example is, giving the same level of information as visual content, is flashbacks and dream sequences, which are not always identified as such in a movie. If the visual content is to some extent ambiguous, the audio description should ideally present the same level of ambiguity. So for example, if there's a flashback and they don't tell you it's a flashback, this happened in Midnight Cowboy, where the main character is played by John Boyd, and then all of a sudden you're in a different place and there's this blonde kid, it's like, I don't know, maybe that's a younger version of John Boyd, but they don't tell you this. So I don't think the audio description should introduce the scene by saying, okay, now you're seeing a flashback, because that would be spoon-feeding the blind audience with more information than the sighted audience is getting from the visual content. What is visual content? Types of visual content includes text on screen, action and reaction, context, and for lack of a better word, describing stuff. Oh, and also sight gags. In rough order of priority, I would say action is the highest priority, and context is right behind that. And from my point of view, describing stuff is the lowest priority. Text on the screen, that's pretty basic and obvious, and also very easy to put into words because it's already in words. Okay, long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. Action is obviously the most important form of visual content because action is what's happening in the movie. For example, he drags the body onto the railroad tracks. Good to know. But there's a lot of more mundane examples, like he nods his head, which is very useful because there are a lot of times when people respond to yes-no questions by either nodding or shaking their head. One issue with action is when there's a group of people, you can have a choice whether to describe the action at the level of the individuals or at the group level. And I have an example from Sharknado, where there's a scene on a beach, and people are doing various stuff. People throwing a beach ball back and forth, and other people are wading in the water and jumping over waves. But it might not be worth that level of detail. This here, I'm going to try one of my audio clips and see what happens.
Meanwhile, on Santa Monica Beach, attractive young people frolic.
I just said, attractive young people frolic, which kind of summarizes what's going on. Another example, this was from The Twilight Zone. There's an episode where they're about to launch a spaceship of some sort. And there's this big room and people doing various things. They're writing stuff down. They're looking at monitors and I don't even know what they're doing. So,
Fox 19 secured.
Mission control is abuzz in preparation for the launch.
Mission control is a buzz, kind of summed up that. The same kind of distinction between individuals and groups, this could apply, I've never done this, but if you were describing a choreography of, for example, a ballet or a football game, you have the same choices. Context, which I put at the next level of priority. There's a lot you can get from the soundtrack, obviously, the dialogue and also the sound effects, but sometimes a little context is helpful for understanding what you're hearing. So for example, with dialogue, it may not be obvious who is speaking, especially the first time a character appears, or the first time they speak. So it may be helpful to identify them. Or the first time a character speaks, there's an issue of identifying who they are. But the assumption in audio description is once you've heard them speak the first time and it's been clear which voice goes with which person, you're supposed to recognize the voice for the rest of the movie and associate with that character, so it doesn't have to be identified. But there can be an issue as to who's talking to whom, especially if there's more than two people in the scene. That's another example of just providing context. And then for sound effects, you know, sometimes something goes boom, might not be obvious as to what caused the sound. When I was talking about there being two people or more than two people in a scene, one of the mundane tasks of audio description is maintaining an inventory of who's there and who's not there. Basically, describing all the entrances and exits so you know who's on the scene. But I wrote down also spatial relationships within the scene. You know, who's close to whom and, you know, who's over and on top of whom. I don't know what I meant by that. If a character is walking towards some, that's an example of action, but it's also really just setting context for who is near whom. More basic level of context is setting the scene as to where things are taking place. This is something in the visual medium is really efficient because, I mean, there's the cliche about a picture being worth a thousand words. A still image in a motion picture can just instantly convey where the action is taking place. Residential street in New York City. Only, you know, that took like, you know, half a second for that to be conveyed. Here are some more pointless audio clips. These are opening scenes of three movies.
Nighttime in Los Angeles.
It is nighttime on a college campus.
A rainy night in the city.
So those were three movies that started at night. And a similar issue is changes of scene. Again, this is something in the visual vocabulary of movies is very economical. As soon as there's a cut from one scene to another, it is immediately obvious to the visual viewer that, okay, this scene is over and we're in a different place. May or may not know what it is or who's there, but it's not the same place. So the inventory of who's there is swept out of the way. So the audio description has to keep up with changes of scene, if nothing else, just to establish a different scene by saying something like elsewhere or later. Okay, when I was talking before about actions and reactions, the part about reactions includes gestures and facial expressions. A lot of the gestures are pretty simple. Part of it is just, like if someone turns their head in reaction to something, like where a character is pointing their eyes is something that is useful to convey. But the more interesting part is facial expressions, because this is a huge part of acting. But there can be a lot of nuance involved that can be hard to describe in facial expressions. Now, I mean, there's some facial expressions that are pretty obvious. You got smile, frown, and I've done here, blank, motionless stare. Then there's more subtle expressions like raising an eyebrow or furrowing your brow. And then there are expressions that I know what they mean, but I think they're very hard to describe physically. Like when somebody's face indicates that they are skeptical or puzzled or pensive or horrified. This kind of violates the rule against interpreting rather than just describing what's going on visually. And I think I may disagree with Joel Snyder on this because he discourages interpreting facial expressions. At least he doesn't come up with a clear rule against it. I thought about this for a while, but I noticed in other movies that were described by professionals, everybody does this on a regular basis. What I realized is that I think it's okay to interpret a facial expression if this is an interpretation that would be obvious to pretty much every sighted person. And I haven't really fleshed this out in terms of which things I think are kosher to do this, but I'm definitely okay with saying the facial expression is skeptical, as if puzzled or pensive or horrified. I'm not sure about frustrated or exasperated. I'll think about those. And now the next category of visual content, and this is the one that I put at low priority, is what I call describing stuff. And it's funny because when you think of description, the first thing that comes to mind is, well, obviously you're describing stuff, but too bad. What I'm talking about here is visual details, which can be about people, or their clothing, or props, or scenery. And, you know, I have to say, even though I'm skeptical of it, I realize that giving detail makes for a much more vivid experience. I'm just a little biased in my own description against making things too ornate. Most of the time, this is all academic anyway, because there just isn't any time available, because you have to fit the descriptions into the gaps in the dialogue. When there is time available, I would prioritize details that I can justify because they have some explanatory value. And this is getting back to the issue as to why is something in the movie. And in a good movie, there's a reason why someone might be wearing a particular type of clothing or why a certain prop is on a table. I would prioritize that as opposed to just detail for detail's sake. For example, no question, I could describe a man wearing a business suit, but I probably wouldn't bother to say he's wearing a black pinstriped suit with a blue tie. Point of this, I'm not really good with clothing. I'm not deeply familiar with all the vocabulary of different types of clothing and fabrics. I think I could get as far as exquisite evening gown. On the other hand, there was one episode of The Twilight Zone where there's a character wearing a plaid jacket with a striped bow tie. And that, I thought, was very clearly put in for a reason to intended the individualism of this particular character. As far as people's physical characteristics, I seldom get beyond young or old or maybe tall or short or chubby. Like in Superman 3, there's one character who is a blonde young lady, and they were definitely going for the stereotype of the dumb blonde. So that, okay, yep, driver, she's blonde. Now there's a general rule, and I definitely agree with Joel Snyder on this, not to mention someone's race unless it is particularly relevant. In the movie Police Academy, there were a couple of characters who were involved in sort of a racial conflict. So there, it was definitely appropriate to mention those characters, and only those characters, as being black or white. And I should also mention that one thing you definitely don't want to do is only mention when someone's black, because that's racist. In Dr. Strangelove, I was considering mentioning this character played by James Earl Jones. It was his first film role. I was considering mentioning that he was black. My reasoning was to make a sort of subtle point about intentional tokenism, which is what I think Kubrick was going for, but I decided that that was too much film school, not really about describing the movie. And speaking of stuff about film school, another thing that is not part of visual content is the cinematography in the movie. I would not describe cinematographic features like close-ups, tracking shots, zooming in, zooming out, or fade to black. Now, I have heard fade to black in other descriptions, but Joe and I agree not to say fade to black, because that is not the content of the movie. That's just a cinematic technique. On the other hand, there are visual effects that I think are worth describing, like shadows and silhouettes. I'm thinking of a film noir, like in A Double Indemnity. There's this very cool effect in this one scene where a man is entering a house, and then his shadow enters the room before he does. And then when he leaves, the shadow follows him out. And I thought that was very cool and definitely worth mentioning. I think whoever did the audio description for The Wizard of Oz would be well within their rights to point out that Oz is in color and Kansas is in black and white. Now, I was talking about the conceptual steps, the perception, prioritization, and putting into words. Putting into words can be a lot of fun, because what makes it interesting to do is the challenge of writing vivid, varied verbiage, I really like alliterations, that can fit into the gaps that you have to fit into. There's a basic rule that you don't step on the dialogue, but there are exceptions, which are probably not worth getting into here. And so the challenge is to convey the maximum meaning in the fewest syllables. Okay, also for vivid and varied verbiage, a lot of that is verbs. If you've ever taken a writing class, or if you read like The Elements of Style, they always tell you that verbs are really important. And I think that's also especially true in audio description, especially if you're describing action. The movie Sharknado, I went back, I actually counted, because I'm that much of a geek, and I think I counted about 150 different verbs. I'm not going to read all 150 of them. I chose the sampling here. Punch, jab, clobber, ram, cram, flatten, crash, thrash, pummel, plunge, plummet, leap, vault, stampede, careen, wobble, splatter, unsheath, jettison, penetrate, pierce, engulf, envelope, and ravage. I'll mention my favorite side gags from the movie Dr. Strangelove. During the opening credits, they put in some footage of aircraft refueling that just so happens to be very sexually suggestive, especially the very first image. It's this close-up of this huge phallic symbol.
thrusting upward, the shaft of the supplying apparatus achieves contact with the receiving equipment. As the necessary fluids are transferred, the coupled aircraft fly in tandem.
Very good.
Another one, technically, I don't know whether this is a sight gag or whether this is just action, because this is a piece of slapstick from Superman 3, which is also offensive to blind people. They have a scene with where a guide dog runs away from a blind man. It's really stupid. You know, I'm watching this and I'm thinking, okay, this is offensive, but this is intended to be humorous. Okay, as a description, I'll just try to make it sound funny.
The guide dog sideswipes a woman with two large grocery bags. Now, without two large grocery bags.
Okay. The script is probably funnier than the visual now. In conclusion, as you probably noticed, I really enjoyed producing audio description, and I hope that people also enjoyed listening to it.
Words appear. The end.
The Movie Vault is a free service of a website called the Blind Mice Mega Mall. The rest of the website is an e-commerce site where you buy stuff, but you can sign up for free. I think you just give them your email address, and then you get lots of email ads from them, but the actual downloads are free. So it's Blind Mice Mega Mall Movie Vault.
It's blindmicemegamall.com, and once you log in, there's a link that says Movie Vault. And if you click on there, it'll show you the latest movies they've put up, and then you can also type in a search box and search for...
Also, blindmicemark.com will work.
Yes.
So there are MP3 files you can download. There's no video.
Correct.
Did somebody teach you these techniques, or did you just develop this from your own experience?
Mostly from my own experience. But then I got the $10 Kindle book last year, and read through his book. A lot of it confirmed things that I had already thought, but there were some things, like the part about describing, not interpreting, was something I hadn't signed on to that yet before I read his book.
I gotta tell you, you've done a hell of a good job of taking something that the rest of us take for granted and really making a very scientific approach.
I agree.
How long does it take to do the average movie?
I'm doing this on an amateur basis and I'm retired, so I just do a few days here, a few days there. But it depends on the movie. Like Superman 3 was an action movie. There was just a lot of stuff to describe. It wasn't necessarily difficult to describe, but there's just a lot of it. There's some battle or fight scenes that was just chock full of this and that and this and that. Whereas, like if you have a movie like All About Eve, something very dialogue intensive, not a lot of action, you can kind of zoom through that fast. Zoom is maybe exaggerating it, but you can at least make more progress getting through that.
What have you learned how to do better in terms of the audio mixing, and what things have you changed in terms of your production procedures?
Well, the main thing is that originally I was scared to alter the original soundtrack because I really thought I would just screw it up. And then I realized that the movie soundtracks can vary a lot in the volume of the sound because of orchestral music. Actually, The Twilight Zone is even worse, and it's mostly just orchestral music. It just gets ridiculously loud on that show. So I've spent more time going through the original soundtrack and reducing the volume of that. That's really the main thing that's changed. But also, just like any other software tool, I use Audacity, which is a very common open source audio editing program. And the more you use it, the better you get a sense for how loud things need to be.
Does Audacity give you the granularity to be able to edit your descriptions down so that it'll fit in the particular place where you want it?
Well, getting it to fit is mostly a question of my reducing the number of syllables in the text that I'm reading. Now, sometimes I can cheat a little bit. There's a feature where you can speed up the sound.
You gotta be careful with that.
Yes, and so I don't like to do that more than, maybe like 7 or 8%. I don't like to use it at all, but if I'm really desperate, I'll use it, except in credits, because who cares about the credits? So I'll speed up the credits, 10% or something, just to fit them in. You can fill up the gap really closely. I mean, I'll move something forwards or backwards, a tenth of a second or even less than that, and I found sometimes I can cheat a little on the both ends of the gap. So if I'm overlapping with, the last syllable of the thing in the previous dialogue, piece of dialogue, and I'm overlapping a little bit with the first syllable that follows it, sometimes you can get away with cheating a little bit like that.
Do you describe things that are designed to evoke other movies? Like, say, especially animated movies, I think, will often include something in the animation that's supposed to evoke or remind people of some past movie that the sighted audience will recognize. And the other thing is, how do you choose the movies that you describe? Do you just do movies you like, or does somebody request specific ones?
Oh, I can answer the second question. Both of those have happened. I just look for movies, like when I just happened to search at the movie vault and I saw no one else had done Dr. Strangelove. I said, well, definitely got to do that, because that's a great movie. The guy I deal with, who is not affiliated with the movie vault, every once in a while he'll just tell me, here are movies that he's gotten requests for, like Superman 3 or Police Academy, which are not movies that would have ever occurred to me on my own. But as far as references to other movies, just from my own knowledge, I don't think I know that enough about other movies to even recognize that that's what's going on. So I would just describe it as somebody who's seeing it for the first time. Whatever is happening visually, like, okay, this person is doing this thing in this setting, and if someone else can recognize from that that's an allusion to something else, that may or may not happen. But I think that to point it out explicitly, saying, oh yeah, and here's a reference to this other movie or other work of literature, I think that would be going beyond description to explanation.
Right. Okay, thank you.
Lou, I had an opportunity to work with the people at Channel 2 who do the DBS. Why don't you go to work for them? You have a tremendous skill.
Well, thank you very much. But right now, I'm building up a portfolio, a resume. The other thing which I discovered last year after going to the Massachusetts ACB event is that there's audio description for live theater. And so I've got some business cards of people who do that. That seems really hard to do because there's no audio editing involved. It's just you get one shot and there's no do-overs. So I've never seen an audio description live. So I went to a play at the Wheelock Family Theater last year, and I hate to say this, but there were only two performances of this particular play that were described, and the one I went to, there were no actual blind people there.
Oh, that's unfortunate.
I felt very, because I went to return my headphones, and there were two people who had been working there, with no actual customers, but they at least they had a groupie. Yeah, I have a lot of respect for people who do that, and it's intriguing to get involved with it, but it just seems like that would be really hard to do. Whereas the doing this stuff in the comfort of my own home with my editing software, also because I'm not doing it professionally, I can do it on my own schedule. I don't have a deadline.
Well, very good. Thank you, Lou. This has been really good.